Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with In Conversation. Last week we began a chat with Dr. Oliver Sacks. It was about music and why our brains are capable of responding so widely, universally and passionately to such a wide variety of sounds, from Leonard Bernstein to Led Zeppelin, from Gregorian chant to Gershwin. How is a brain that developed to cope with cave dwelling and forests able to relish Mozart? And how do our minds suddenly show a hunger for music, sometimes after an accident or disease? Dr. Sacks describes many brain malfunctions in his new book, Musicophilia. So what is going on?
Well, the music is a sort of organic unity. It has its own law and pattern. Each bar comes organically from what went before and leads on to the next one. There's the momentum of the music and the rhythm, and the music holds together as a work of art. And as Schopenhauer liked to say, melody has significant intentionality. It's like a single thought from beginning to end.
Dr. Sacks, could you tell the story, just to illustrate this, the story with which you open the book of the doctor in the telephone booth who's suddenly hit by lightning and who becomes obsessed by Chopin?
Yeah, well, he was in his early 40s, an orthopedist, a former football player, not too much interested in music, and he was on the phone, it was 15 years ago, in a thunderstorm, and a bolt of lightning flew out from the phone, hit him in the face, knocked him back a dozen yards, and in essence, killed him briefly. He had a cardiac arrest. He had one of these strange out-of-body experiences in which he seemed to be floating upside down about 10 feet above the ground and saw his inanimate body and someone, a seemingly inanimate body, and someone applying artificial respiration. Anyhow, he then went on to one of these strange so-called near-death experiences with a bright light and a rush of memories. Be that as it may, he came back suddenly when his heart was restarted, and then he thought he was pretty much normal. He felt rather dazed, but he was able to resume work in 2 or 3 days. And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, he got this sudden, insatiable desire, as he put it, to listen to piano music. And he got very turned on by a Vladimir Ashkenazi tape of Chopin. And then he wanted to play the pieces there, even though he couldn't play and he couldn't read music. And then he started to have dreams in which he was performing his own music, and he would wake from the dream and the music would still be going through his head. And so he sort of had a transformation, really, in the course of a few days, from a rather non-musical person to a passionately musical person. He got himself a piano, he got himself a piano teacher, and basically his life was changed from that point on. He continued to work as a surgeon, but he'd get up at 3 or 4 in the morning and practice or try and write down the compositions which were flooding through his mind. And he's still doing that. And very recently in New York, he gave a performance of his latest work, which he has called The Lightning Sonata.
Was it any good?
Well, I think it's quite nice, sort of rather Chopin-esque writing. But then, you know, since Chopin is his idol, so it may be a little derivative. But it's certainly fluent and pleasant, and he plays nicely. And this for a man who apparently scarcely had a musical bone in his body before this happened.
Yes, and he's virtually changed his whole personal life. He's divorced. Obviously, this obsessiveness drove his ex-wife nuts, and she couldn't stand it anymore. And he seems to have no particular remorse about the fact that he's sacrificed these personal things for his music.
Well, you may be putting it a little too strongly there. I mean, he did say that, you know, when he started spending all his spare time on music, it was his wife wasn't best pleased. But whether, you know, the subsequent divorce was, you know, was to do with this or not, I don't know. I think he's quite a devoted father, and he's devoted to his patients. But he has been very, very dedicated. And there's a sort of mystical or religious feeling which goes with this. He feels that he was, in a sense, singled out for the thunderbolt, singled out to be revived because an emergency room nurse was standing right behind him waiting to use the phone. If she hadn't been there, he would not have survived. And he partly feels that the music which runs constantly in his mind comes, it is as if it comes from heaven, and his mission is to sort of bring it to earth.
Yes, Mozart said that about the music coming from heaven, and he was simply dictating it, and there was so much music, he could not possibly in his lifetime write all the notes down.
Yeah, I think Tony the surgeon feels a little similar, and although he is no Mozart, there does seem to be a sort of non-stop stream of music coming to him, as if some parts of his brain have been released or activated, some reorganization has occurred. Originally, he was very much against any sort of investigation. He said he wanted to put a spiritual explanation on it. And I said, well, that's okay, but might not divine intervention operate via the nervous system? And he said, okay. I mean, I'm not in the business of judgment. I listen to what people say, but this way is, he can keep divine intervention and I can look at the nervous system.
Quite amazing.
With music. Yeah.
Now, this is a question based on hubris, although it's reverse hubris in some way. Would you tell us about the Williams syndrome?
Yes, the Williams syndrome was described by a namesake of yours, but not, I presume, a relative. I think he was a New Zealand cardiologist who in the 1960s described this syndrome in children who didn't have enough elastic tissue in their body, so they had various problems with the heart and the great vessels, and also they looked a little unusual. He commented briefly on their mental state, but this was really only clarified later. People with Williams syndrome have an extraordinary mix of gifts and defects. They are precocious socially, verbally, and musically, and they're quite severely retarded and defective in most other ways, so that they cannot in general live independently, they can't understand change, they can't do arithmetic, they can't tie their shoelaces, but they are charming, excessively friendly, excessively loquacious, music-loving people, invariably. Quite a lot of them are musically talented as well, but 100% of them are enraptured by music and swoon over it, cry over it. They're quite overwhelmed by music. And my first encounter with people with Williams, in fact, was at a music camp especially designed for them.
Describe it. What happened there?
Well, there were about 40 people at this camp, and although they varied in age from sort of 5 to 50, and they were both sexes, they all looked like members of the same family. There was really an astonishing basic sort of anatomical similarity and a similarity of behavior. It was almost like seeing a clone or a tribe. And as soon as I got to the camp, there was none of the hesitation one usually has. I was immediately asked about my car, my clothes, my life, everything. They wanted to know all about me. I sort of felt, as it were, devoured by their... I'm rather on the shy side, and they were clearly far in the opposite direction. They need social contacts, and being with other people is essential for people with Williams syndrome. But a lot of their talk was about music. When two people with Williams meet, they're singing together or whatever, or they're talking about music. And quite a lot of them played instruments. I'd known about their loquacity and their friendliness, but their musicality sort of hit me then. And what one finds in the brain is a sort of reflection of this, that the temporal lobes of the brain, the parts of the brain which are involved in speech and music, are of normal size and sometimes supernormal size, whereas the other parts of the brain concerned with vision and so forth are diminished in size. There's a clear sort of genetic reason for this, but really Williams syndrome has allowed one to match up genes, brain anatomy, and behavior and psychology more accurately than any other condition.
So often you can find dysfunction gives you an illumination of what's normal. And I wonder, as a sort of final example, before I ask you about your own performance, your own mazurkas, could you tell us about the woman who had various difficulties with almost, I suppose, hallucination with music, who was improved dramatically by having a cochlear implant?
Yeah, Cheryl, she came to me probably about 6 or 7 years ago, a very nice, intelligent woman with severely impaired hearing. She had very advanced hearing aids and she had to watch my face, otherwise she didn't know what I was saying. A couple of months earlier, she had had a further decrement of hearing. She'd become almost absolutely deaf. She'd been put on prednisone, on a steroid medication. And after taking that for 7 or 8 days, she said she was woken at night by a tremendous hubbub outside. She heard bells, sounds, voices, shouting, an engine going. She rushed to the window to look at the fire engine, which she assumed had stopped outside, and there wasn't a fire engine. And at that point, she realized that she was hallucinating. The noises of the fire engine were replaced about half an hour later by a song, I think it was called Michael, Row Your Boat.
Yes.
And with the same almost deafening intensity, hallucinations can be physically very loud, like tinnitus. They can be deafeningly loud. And then the sort of Michael, Row Your Boat was followed by the development of other hallucinatory tunes, sometimes sort of 4 or 5 bars, which would repeat again and again.
What do you think was going on there? What do you think was happening?
I think when there was a sort of a critical loss of input to the auditory parts of the brain, they sort of went into reverse and started to regurgitate things, first noises and voices and then music. Musical hallucinations, 80 or 90% of them occur in people who have fairly advanced deafness, like this lady. Now, one would think, therefore, that if one could restore hearing, either with hearing aids or with a cochlear implant, this would provide a relatively normal input to the auditory parts of the brain. This would stop the hallucinations. But this was not the case with this lady. Her hearing is greatly improved by the implant, but the hallucinations go on. They seem to have a sort of momentum of their own, and I think this is often the case with musical hallucinations, that once they get going and once they get entrenched, especially if the person is somewhat deaf, they stay there, although mostly people come to terms with them, sometimes very amicable terms, and the music ceases to be intrusive, and some people can even enjoy it somewhat.
Yes, tinnitus, the sound in your ear that some people get later in life, can become that kind of musical distortion as well, can't it?
Yeah, I've got tinnitus. I hear it now. It goes sss, yes, like that. There's some tinnitus as like a ring, though one of my correspondents, actually a violinist in Australia, told me that his tinnitus was a high F natural.
He seemed to be unaware
that this is an accuracy sort of unavailable to most people.
And then it can turn into Stockhausen or something.
Yeah. Now, tinnitus may sort of lead on to musical hallucinations. Mostly it doesn't. And lots of people have musical hallucinations without any preceding tinnitus. I'm mildly deaf myself, and I've been wondering if I would go on to any musical hallucination. If so, what it would be. I would like to think it would be sort of, you know, Bach or the Christmas Oratorio or something, but I think it might be A Bicycle Made for Two, because this is a song my mother sang to me when I was, I don't know, two or 3 years old, and I can easily imagine it in her voice.
She had mild hallucinations as well with music, didn't she?
Well, on one occasion, she was 75, which seemed terribly old at the time, but now I'm 74. It doesn't seem that old.
I know the feeling.
She was rather unlike my father, who was intensely musical, my mother had difficulty retaining a tune voluntarily, and therefore she was astounded when she woke up one morning and said she was hearing songs from the Boer War. And I had a tape recorder. I had her sing some of these. She got all the lyrics, and although she was slightly off key, she was obviously hearing the music. I mean, she didn't call it a hallucination. She didn't know what to call it. She knew it wasn't real, but she herself had had some training in neurology. She was a surgeon, and she wondered if one of her medications for high blood pressure was acting up, or whether there'd been a little stroke. Whatever it was, these songs sort of lasted for 3 days and then disappeared. So one can have these sort of transient hallucinations as well.
Yes, there's something underneath leaking out. Now, are you still playing yourself mazurkas?
Yeah, I have my old piano, or my father's old piano. It's a lovely 1894 Bechstein. And although I'm not sure that I would like others to hear me, I need to play the piano somewhat, as I think every day, as well as listen to the piano. It's not sufficient for me listening. I have to make music. Or sometimes I just keep a notebook on the piano. I'm right-handed, and my left hand is sort of vaguely improvising different chords and things. But I do find the piano sort of a very important companion.
Mainly mazurkas? You don't play jazz or anything rather more
upbeat?
I'm
afraid I've been rather limited and classical. I grew up with Bach, and then when I was an adolescent, I became very fond of sort of Chopin and Schumann and the Romantics. At one time, absurdly, I learned all the Chopin mazurkas by heart. I'd been listening to, this sounds a little bit like Trattoria's thing, I'd been listening to Rubinstein's recordings of the mazurkas, and I was ravished. I find 60 years later, although I haven't done any systematic practice for 60 years, I still have them basically at my fingertips. And as soon as one of them starts in my mind, then maybe, as with Clive, it will play itself. People talk about muscle memory. I prefer the term procedural memory. But I think that when one has learned something by heart and rehearsed it, whether it's a simple performance like, whatever, cleaning one's teeth, or a complex one like playing mazurka, it's with you for life, even if you become severely demented.
Yes, the people in Awakenings, after 40 years, the music was still there, with wonderful accuracy in the notes. And of course you also talk about in the book the Asperger's people who've got hundreds of works which they know completely and can notate them without hesitation. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of operas.
Yeah, well certainly a musical savant, so-called, who these savants are, they usually have a autism of a less articulate kind than Asperger's, but one can have the highest musical intelligence, at least of a reproductive sort and a memorial sort, in the absence of much else. I don't know whether there have been any sort of great sort of autistic creative musicians, but there have been some amazing performers.
I was talking to Dr. Oliver Sacks in our studio in New York. His latest book is called Musicophilia, and it has lots of case histories, lots of ideas, and plenty of science. Next week, another book, A Fragile Balance. I shall be in conversation with Professor Christopher Dickman about his wonderful, gorgeously illustrated book on Australian marsupials. Are they leftover creatures marooned at the end of the world, or specialised animals of extraordinary sophistication? That's next week. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.